Boston. Now, the Orioles are also sending outfielder Taylor Ward to the Mariners for three right-handed pitchers. The Guardians got outfielder Joe Adell from the Angels today. Angels were busy. They dealt reliever Brent Suter to the Braves and starter Jose Soriano to the Toronto Blue Jays. The Marlins sent catcher Liam Hicks to the Tampa Bay Rays, while the Phillies acquired second baseman Luis Arraez in a trade with the Giants. Reliever Caleb Killian is also headed to Philly in that deal. The Giants dealt pitcher Robbie Ray to the San Diego Padres. USC and Notre Dame will renew their rivalry in college football starting in 2030 as the schools agreed to a four-year deal to play the game. Bears safety Kobe Bryant's going to miss 8 to 10 weeks after hyperextending his knee in practice today. That's according to ESPN. Mauricio Pochettino has agreed to an extension with the U.S. men's national team.
Fox Sports update on the Right Choice KPRL brought to you by Deeds Bar and Grill at the Paso Robles Golf Club. Great food, great view, great people. Prime Rib Monday, Taco Tuesday, specials on wine, and dinner specials Thursday through Saturday. Today in Farming on KPRL is brought to you by Paso Robles Glass, established in 1947, always up on the latest technology and training. They do windows right. Call Paso Robles Glass, 805-238-4014.
From the Ag Information Network, I'm Bob Larson with your agribusiness update. Well, a coalition of advocacy, legal, and photojournalists are urging the FAA to reject a proposal that would allow large livestock operations and slaughterhouses to restrict drone flights over their facilities. The groups say allowing unmanned aircraft flight restrictions would limit aerial photography that has documented manure spills, disease outbreaks, livestock housing conditions, and other issues at large animal operations. They contend additional flight restrictions would reduce transparency. Well, Senate Ag Committee Democrats are warning that a proposed reorganization of USDA's rural development area could limit access to critical programs. Senators Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota, Peter Welch of Vermont, and 20 colleagues say the plan could impact services that support rural businesses, housing, health clinics, child care, water systems, electric projects, and broadband expansion. The senators say rural development needs enough experienced staff to process applications and deliver funding. Well, USDA is reminding farmers and ranchers that deadlines are coming for several programs designed to help offset higher input costs and disaster recovery. The Farm Service Agency says applications for the Assistance for Specialty Crop Farmers are due August 7th, while the Supplemental Disaster Relief Program deadline is August 12th. And eligible landowners have until August 31st to review potential base acre increases for the Agriculture Risk and Price Loss Coverage Programs.
You've probably been told that to reach a millennial farmer, you have to go digital. Facebook, Vimeo, YouTube, Instagram, Pinterest, LinkedIn, an online publication, or maybe a podcast. But which one? Oh, and how receptive is this age group to your sales pitch during non-work social time? Maybe the best place to reach a farmer with a farming solution message is when they are, well, quite frankly, farming. You know, it's easy for us to find them during the day, as most farmers are behind the wheel of a pickup truck or farm equipment with the radio on, listening to this station featuring the Ag Information Network News. If you'd like to deliver information about your terrific product or service, give us a call and we'll connect you directly with our community of loyal farmer listeners. Reach real farmers right here, right now, as they listen to what is important to their farm operation. They trust us, they'll trust you.
With your agribusiness update, I'm Bob Larson.
Today in Farming on KPRL is brought to you by Paso Robles Glass, established in 1947, always up on the latest technology and training. They do windows right. Call Paso Robles Glass, 805-238-4014.
This Fox Business News update on KPRL is brought to you by Stifel, your full-service wealth management firm since 1890. Stifel, located at 1337 Vine Street in Paso Robles. Call 805-238-3080. Stifel, 238-3080.
I'm Maria Bartiromo, and this is the Fox Business Report.
Stocks are climbing as President Trump's latest pivot back to diplomacy in the Middle East sent oil prices sliding. Shares of Palantir are up 2%. The data analytics and AI company will report earnings after the closing bell today. Shares of GameStop are down over 14% after the company says it will swap $1.4 billion worth of debt for stock. Northrop Grumman shares are up about 0.5%. The defense contractor says it signed two multi-year agreements with the Pentagon and Lockheed Martin. Campari is pouring Aperol into new territory, targeting the beer-centric world of stadiums and concerts. The beverage company recently tried out a new way of serving that spritz cocktail. At events where speed is of the essence, it was put on tap, eliminating the need for staff to do the mixing. That is your Fox Business Report. I'm Angelo Bavaro. Invest it in you.
It's Will Kane Country.
The calculation is, did you follow the code? And the other is more simple. This is Trump derangement syndrome, and that is not American left. The entire globe is suffering from Trump derangement syndrome, and they see this story as simply Donald Trump pressed the easy button. Ref gave red card, he pulled Trump card, and they're freaking out on that simple basis. That explains, I think, what we're seeing from the world.
Get the podcast 5 days a week at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
This Fox Business News update on KPRL brought to you by Stifel, your full-service wealth management firm since 1890. Stifel, located at 1337 Vine Street in Paso Robles. Call 805-238-3080. Stifel, 238-3080.
American Legends, next on KPRL. Brought to you by Davis Body Shop.
What happens to citizen participation when government units consolidate? I'll be right back.
Reagan, in his own voice, is brought to you by Mills Construction. For architectural, metal, roofing, and siding, call Aaron at 610-1256.
Yesterday, I discussed a study on local government reform which must have confounded the liberal establishment wherever it was read, because it gave the lie to that old saw that only big government can meet the needs of the people. The study to which I refer was done, I must admit, by a task force I appointed in 1973 when I was still governor of California. It was and is one of those rarities, a study done by a group of independent experts that came up with answers totally contrary to the conventional wisdom of our day. Some of these answers it found are worth repeating because they reflect feelings the average man finds difficult to express, and when he does express them, finds all too often that those in authority will not listen. For instance, the study found that the average citizen's satisfaction with government increases as the size of the governmental unit gets smaller. He also found that there's a strong desire among the people for decentralizing governmental authority and responsibility. In large central cities, there's also a significant demand for some form of neighborhood organization to affect the delivery of public goods and services. Power to the people, it seems, is more than just a radical slogan. It's also a need felt by a good many citizens. The study also finds that there's a strong preference by citizens toward maintaining the autonomy of local governments, and that they want to decide the structure of their local government at the ballot box rather than through the legislature or even through appointed local officials. Our study also took a look at local government reform in socialist Sweden, where they reduced the number of local governments from 2,500 to 250. They found that these things resulted: voter participation in local elections declined, citizen participation in volunteer civic and service organizations declined, local elected officials began to differ markedly from the bulk of their constituents and tended to follow the dictates of their consciences rather than the wishes of their constituents. And finally, the resistance of elected officials to spending programs decreased. It's all quite reminiscent of what's been happening here in America in recent years as government has grown bigger and more powerful. Here, too, voter participation has been declining. Fewer and fewer people are taking an interest in volunteer activities. It's easier to let the government do it. Too often our elected officials cease to represent us and instead inflict their views on us. And finally, you may have noticed, the bigger government gets, the bigger a chunk of our income it takes, and the more it spends on your behalf, whether you want it or not. A little bit of Sweden, it appears, is a little bit of knowledge. It can be a dangerous thing to our heritage of keeping government close responsive, and responsible to the people. We've already lost a lot of that heritage. Only we, the people, can make sure that we don't lose it all. This is Ronald Reagan. Thanks for listening.
Reagan, in his own voice, brought to you by Mills Construction, specializing in pre-engineered metal buildings. Call Aaron at 610-1256.
KPRL presents Sound Off, the longest-running radio talk show in San Luis Obispo County. Sound Off on the North County's choice for local talk, KPRL. The views and opinions expressed on Sound Off do not necessarily reflect those of KPRL, its management, staff, or sponsors.
Sound Off on AM 1230, KPRL, and 99.3 FM is brought to you by Davis Body Shop, your auto collision specialist in Paso Robles and Atascadero.
This is Sound Off, where the North County comes to talk on The Right Choice, KPRL.
Good afternoon and welcome to Sound Off on this Monday afternoon. Kevin Will, and our special guest this afternoon is no stranger to the airwaves here on, well, Sound Off and the North County, Al Fonzie. Al, thank you for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me on again.
All righty. First things first, we were talking a little bit about it, that we all wish you and Roberta doing well. How have you adjusted to life in East Tennessee?
For the most part, pretty good. You know, the weather is a little squirrely from time to time. We've had some really wet, hot summers the last 2 years, wetter than people say it's been. And the year before that, of course, we had that hurricane that sat over the Carolinas for a while. And just, you know, we got all the rain in the mountains and the flooding, had local flooding here as well. And a lot of very severe warnings, storm warnings coming across the area, although none of them have really hit us. My first year here, they hit my house inadvertently, not directly, but I had a whole bunch of trees in the back, and we had a storm come through one night, and it flattened every one of them. 60-foot trees were down all over the place. So I don't have any big trees on my property anymore, just the ones I planted in the front yard, and that's it. So,
you know, just curious, since you mentioned that flood from a couple of years ago, I know some bridges were taken out. How was the response back in Tennessee for getting those things cleaned up and either repaired or fixed completely?
Well, here in Elizabethton, we had a historic bridge that was rendered unusable. It wasn't washed away, but it was severely damaged underneath. It took about a year to get fixed. They had to do some really major. They had to have the water go down, and once it did, and the storms slacked off, they're able to start work. But it took about 6 or 7 months to actually get the footings redone and everything built, make it safe. But we had to do a wide detour to go from one end of town to the other because this town's oriented east-west, a lot like Tascadero's oriented north-south, and it's got a long strip, so do we. And you just couldn't get there from here. We had to take about a mile detour out of the way to get anywhere for quite some time. So that was kind of interesting. And they had floods in the heart of the town, too. They have two rivers that meet here in Elizabethton. You have the Watauga River and the Doe River. And the Doe River came out of the mountains from Hampton. Hampton was hit extremely hard. The water just came roaring out of the gorges from these flash floods, wiped out the high school, the fire station, some other things, did a lot of damage there. Further south of us in Irwin, they had a factory there, and the floods, waters came up so fast, a bunch of workers were trapped on top of the roof, and a number of them couldn't be rescued. They were drowned. Mm-hmm. So it was pretty severe here, and that's what happened.
All right, and one real quick question here. What are you paying for gas?
Oh, just over $3 a gallon.
Okay.
Right, and when I got here, it was 282. It went down to 239. Because of what's going on in the Gulf, it's gone up a bit, but it's dropping. I've never paid more than about 350 a gallon here. That's at the worst so far.
All right. So since you mentioned the Gulf, let's jump right into this with your years of serving our country and so forth. And you've always been an observer, even after you retired, of what is taking place, but also an historian on wars around the world in general. From the beginning of this, what were your thoughts when President Trump made the move?
Well, when he does, when you do something like this, I assume that they did a lot of planning, gave him lots of options and things like that. I was very disappointed at the beginning. He says our objective is not to take down the regime. This regime is not like normal Western civilization regimes. The best analogy I can give you is fighting the Japanese in the Pacific in World War II, and they absolutely would not surrender because of the code of Bushido. They would not, it was considered dishonorable to surrender. They wouldn't give way. And even after two atomic bombs were dropped, the war council was deadlocked and surrendering or continue to fight. In fact, one group wanted to fight until every last man, woman, child in Japan was dead. They trained schoolgirls with spears to hit us, you know, to attack our soldiers on the beaches. Well, the emperor made the decision. He said, no, we're going to endure the unendurable. And even after he made that decision, there was an attempted coup to keep him from broadcasting that to the allies or to the nation. That's how dug in they were. These guys are just as dug in. The Shia, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps especially, they're very hardcore. They're theologically motivated. In the Shia religion, they have to create the conditions for their Mahdi, their Messiah, to come back. And to do that, they have to create chaos. They have to create a worldwide cataclysm, basically. Dying for them is just entrance into a better life. And the true believers, that's where they're at. And the people that live there, that run the country, I mean, these are people that slaughtered, what, 30,000, maybe 50,000 civilians, young people on the streets in January of this year. How do you negotiate something like that? How do you make deals with that? You don't make deals with people like that. You basically dictate terms. You put your boot on their chest and a bayonet at their throat, and you say, surrender or die. And that's what it comes down to. He's been trying to negotiate with these guys like they're business people, and they're not. And that's why he's so frustrated. Now, to go in there, they went in there and they said, we're not going to take out the regime. When I was in the Army Advanced Course for officers, we basically war game going into Iran, what it would take. And it's an extremely hard fight to do, and it takes a lot of people. And that's when we had 750,000 men in the Army. We only have a third of the combat power we had in the 1990s. We don't have the power to do all this and everything else as well. So going into Iran like we are, trying to do everything with air power, yeah, you can take out conventional forces. We took out most of their air defenses. We took out their air force. We sank their conventional navy. But their strength was never in their conventional forces. Their strength is primarily in their ability to conduct asymmetrical warfare, such as using small, fast, high-speed boats equipped with rocket launchers, mortars, and heavy machine guns to attack commercial shipping. And that's how you shut down the Persian Gulf. You don't need a high-speed destroyer or something like that, or a frigate to do that. You can do it with small boats. You can lay mines. They've done that. They're doing it with drones, because the driver of what's going to go through that strait is not necessarily the Iranians or us. It's insurance companies. Lloyd's of London says, I'm not going to insure your vessel. So they basically park at one end of the Gulf or the other, and traffic is not moving. And they didn't have the carrier support they're supposed to have to bring another carrier in from the Pacific. They didn't have any minesweepers. Now, why would you start a war in the Persian Gulf knowing that they have minesweeping ability, knowing that in Proceedings, which is the Journal of the Naval Institute, for years has been talking about our lack of minesweeping and counter-minesweeping ability. Why would you not have that? Why didn't you bring in our allies who have a lot of that capability and get them on board at the beginning? Why didn't you bring on the American people and say, this is the threat? We tried to take it out last summer. They're still continuing to build their nuclear weapons and bring them on board. You don't take a republic like ours to war without bringing on the American people and giving a good reason why. He didn't do that. In World War II, in the middle of the war, they came out, Frank Capra was a producer, came out with a series called Why We Fight, to educate the American people why this war had to be fought. Because in 1940, we were still having soldiers carry wooden rifles, and we had mock-ups, you know, cardboard mock-ups of tanks, because we weren't, you know, ready for any kind of war just yet. And it took almost 2 years to get our logistics capabilities up and running so we could do that. We haven't done any of those things. We have not explained to the American people, the Democrats, because it's Trump, they hate him, anything he does, have done all they can to impede his ability to conduct the war. But he's also vacillating back and forth. He says, we're going to bomb them on Saturday. Well, why tell them anything? If you're going to bomb them, do it. But don't tip them off that we're going to do such and such on such and such dates. You give them an ultimatum that we'll do it, but then when you make a threat, you better carry it through. And he's been going back and forth. He stopped on April 8th, two-thirds of the way through their target list, and said, okay, now we're going to negotiate, and he didn't go back and finish the job. Well, we wasted 2.5 months just basically trying to get them to come to the negotiating table, trying to do diplomacy with people who are masters at diplomacy and deception. And the result was, we're still sitting here today. He was going to launch a massive strike this weekend. He didn't do it. And the Iranians say, there's no negotiations going on, and we're not going to give in. Well, all we have to do is wait.
Well, you know, you mentioned the American people. And, again, I'm like you from, you know, maybe the first week into this. I keep hearing about how we've destroyed this, we've destroyed that. And, you know, this last chance warning. So my point about the American people, why don't people in the administration understand is you keep saying these things over and over, you're losing the American people because we're not believing you.
Well, that's a problem. You know, Trump likes to exaggerate. I mean, you know, I never heard anybody describe a piece of chocolate cake as a beautiful piece of chocolate cake before, but that's kind of like what he does. Everything is exaggerated so much, you got to say, okay, if he says it's 100, it's probably 80 or 90. But in this case, this is very serious business. You cannot exaggerate what you've actually done. If he gone in and said, this is going to be a hard slog, Iran is not easy, we have to do it for these reasons. We've done about 70% or 80%, but we still have to do this to finish them off. And the last 10%, which is still lethal, is going to be as hard to do as probably the first 90%. And that's sometimes how it is. Not having a ground component to take these guys out, not being willing to go into the ground and have the intelligence agencies ahead of time go in and set up the ability to come up with dissident groups and says, okay, we're going to attack them on the ground. We're going to have their own resistance there leading the way, so to speak, backed up by our air power, backed up by our armor, backed up by our forces to take them out. Then you would have your popular uprising because they wouldn't be getting slaughtered in the streets. We can arm them. We can fund them. We can train them. We send them in and make that happen. We didn't have anything. So the Revolutionary Guard Corps, which is the center of gravity for the Iranian ability to maintain control of that country and do what they're doing, is not as completely decimated as it used to be. In fact, they just started talking about, we're going to take out the Revolutionary Guard. And I'm saying, what do you mean you're going to take out the Revolutionary Guard? That should have been the highest on your target list. You take out the leadership, but you take out their ability to wage war. Why don't you have a target list of where all the drones are, where they're being launched? They disperse them. We have this illusion or this myth in American culture that we're invincible. We go in there, we know everything is, we can take everything out. Well, in the Gulf War, 1990, we had a heck of a time taking out Saddam Hussein's ballistic missiles, his ground-launch missiles that he had. And we never did get them from the air. They had a lot of decoys. We had to send in special forces teams to find them and blow them up on the ground for the most part. There might have been some success, but nothing to the degree that people think that we've got these precision-guided munitions going in and we can take out everything. You can if you find them, but you got to know where they're at. And by taking out the ability to go in on the ground, take and hold territory, and get popular uprisings going to get rid of this regime, because they're not that popular. It's about 20% of the population loves them and really supports them, and 80% can't stand them. And they're absolutely, totally ruthless in what they will do. And it seems like Donald Trump, President Trump, wants to be liked. He wants the Nobel Peace Prize. He may have had in his mind it's going to be an in-and-out, quick-and-done kind of thing. We destroyed everything that's of value to them. But that hasn't been the case. I'll give you an example. One of the things we were taking out, we took out the conventional Navy pretty easy. But when we had to take out these fast patrol boats they had, manned with machine guns, heavy machine guns, rocket launchers they put on them, and mortars and things like that, we had a heck of a time. One of our destroyers tried to take them out, and they have that single gun you see on the bow of our destroyers and things like that. And, well, that's an automatic cannon. It's computer-aimed and, you know, fired, things like that. Well, the computer wasn't able to adjust fast enough for the maneuvers that these boats were able to make. They go 50, 60 knots, and they couldn't do it. They finally had to get offline computer, put it on manual. They finally got one. The way they took out the rest of them that they were able to get was with attack helicopters. But we found out we couldn't get close enough into shore because our vessels drew too much water, and they were moving so fast our computers couldn't adjust fast. We were firing about 80 yards behind these things every time we tried to take one out with conventional munitions. So a lot of lessons learned, but not very good planning ahead as far as being able to take these guys out.
Well, and, that goes to the question is, realistically, can you negotiate in good faith with these people and think that it's going to be anything that's lasting?
the way you negotiate with these people is, like I said in the beginning, you put a bayonet at their throat and you get to that point, and that's how you negotiate. And they can die if they want. You have to be willing to plunge it in if you have to. I mean, it's kind of ruthless and bloodthirsty, but that's how you deal with people that would rather die than surrender. That's what we did with the Japanese. You know, you look at Iwo Jima. You know, they had 22,000 Japanese Marines basically there fighting to the death, dug in and fighting to the death. And I think they captured about 200 of them total. That's how many, you know, all those. Plus, you know, they took out 7,000 Marines, basically decimated two Marine regiments in the process, American regiments.
Mm-hmm.
And in combat ineffective because they're willing to fight and die in place.
Yep. Hold on. For those, if you'd like to ask Al a question, go ahead and text the 805-238-5775 text, and I'll read that on the air. Okay, Al, so, you know, we hear about this 47 years. If we go back, how many mistakes have we made over the years that allowed them to get this to this point?
Well, I go back to Ronald Reagan when he was there. I loved Ronald Reagan as a president. I loved his sense of humor and everything else. But his staff was divided. His cabinet was divided. You had George Shultz, Secretary of State, saying we need to hit them back, got to do these things, hit them hard. When they tortured our CIA station chief to death, when they blew up embassies in other places, when they killed 242 Marines, remember, in 1983, October 23rd, 83. They kidnapped our CIA station chief. They took out one of our liaisons, military liaison officers, and tortured him to death. They put, later on, you know, I gathered information that they were infiltrating Iraq when I was there in 2004, and basically massive intrusion into Iraq and subverting our operations there. But what happened is George Shultz says, yeah, we got to hit him. Caspar Weinberger, Secretary of Defense, kept saying, no, we can't do this. And he was demanding everything be legally perfect until they had the absolute confirmation that they had somehow violated American law. Like killing Americans, like when they killed those people in the La Bella Disco Club in Berlin, and I forget what year, though, I think it was 85, 86, they finally had enough provocation in the mind of Caspar Weinberger, because they actually killed Americans in Germany at that point. They could trace it directly to Iran. They decided, yeah, we'll hit back. And actually, he was hitting back Libya at that time, not Iran. But, you know, the reluctance to use sufficient force is considered weakness in a lot of these cultures. I mean, they looked at us and they said, you guys are soft. When they did something like that to the Russians basically took one of their leaders back there, captured him on the streets, and handed him back his head, literally, and said, this is only the beginning. And they didn't make any qualms about it and how they dealt with him. They were not picked on again by these terrorist groups in the areas that they operated in. The Russians are absolutely ruthless. They know how to deal with ruthless people. But we have to make sure every I is dotted, every T is crossed, at least in the minds of some people, when you're dealing in this kind of a war. And it's a very dirty, nasty kind of business. And their whole policy is to kill civilians. They killed a lot of Americans over the years. Iran took our people hostage, the American embassy. They blew up the Marine barracks. They blew up our embassy twice in Beirut. Hezbollah has been armed and trained and funded by Iran for years, attacking both Israel, attacking Americans, killing Americans in the process. There are a number of American citizens were killed on October 23rd. They have dual citizenship, and they happened to be there. And our response needs to be fierce, absolutely fierce, to destroy these groups. Nothing less than saying you can't have nuclear weapons and you cannot fund terrorist groups.
Well, considering how divided the country is that even possible to get the backing of the American people anymore?
Probably not. Not in the current condition. I mean, this is why I said you have to bring the American people along. He should have had someone like Frank Capra putting out the information to the American people, reminding them what it is. We've got a whole generation of people now who are in their 40s and 50s that do not know what happened 40 or 50 years ago because they were kids. They weren't paying attention to the news. When you're talking the 80s, that's like 40-plus years ago. And unless you were, you know, 20 years old at that time, you're probably not too awfully aware of what actually took place in faraway places and named places you can't even name or pronounce.
Well, do you think it would take something absolutely tragic for the American people to finally wake up?
Well, how tragic does 9/11 have to be? I mean, that happened.
Well, we have short
25 years.
We have short memories.
Yeah, I know, but on the 25th anniversary of that, you know, basically, what do? We've elected Mondami, an Islamist mayor of the city of New York, who's persecuting allowing persecution of his Jewish population and basically supporting people who burn American flags and denigrate all of our institutions. He's right alongside. You got a rise of socialism in the country, and people would think this is going to be the panacea to all their perceived problems and things that they don't like in the world. And they don't have any knowledge of history. They don't have any knowledge of civics. The people that are backing that stuff tend to be upper class or wealthy white liberals. For whatever reason, I don't understand their thinking on this sometimes, but they think by supporting these people, life will be better. I don't know why they... Go ahead.
Well, you know, when you mention the socialism, you know, I've heard, you know, some people say, well, you know, overall, it's not really a lot of people, but, you know, you've especially have talked about it for quite a few years. How concerned are you for the future regarding this... what we're seeing in our face, socialism.
It's dark. Unless the other side, less conservatives, unless the average American wakes up and smells the coffee. I mean, the Bolshevik Revolution was a small minority that formed a coup in Russia. And it took over from the other group that already had the first Russian Revolution, and they basically were willing to use an iron fist to govern. What people need to know about socialism is that, you know, and the difference between how we talk about things. Let me just go back a little bit. When we talk to people about economic systems, we like to talk about capitalism. Well, kids have been indoctrinated about capitalism as a bad word as long as I can remember. When you say that, brings up images of that little guy in a top hat in the Monopoly game. You know, that's the capitalist, the rich capitalist doesn't care about people. And that's what they've been taught in school for generations now. You talk instead about free markets and free enterprise because our system is about freedom. It's about freedom of choice. It's about opportunity. It's about hope. Socialism is the exact opposite. It's about coercion. It's about control. And on the smallest level, you can think of what is it like to have socialist control. A number of years ago, I mentioned on the radio that they had a bunch of state inspectors come down from Sacramento and basically went into barbershops, but especially beauty parlors and things like that, and began writing up citations left and right. Like one girl who was working in her position had a $600 fine because she hadn't had a lid on a trash can, some things like that, and just took her entire week's pay. And it was devastating to small, you know, the average workers, small businesses, and things like that. That's what socialism means. It means you lose choices. It means you have shortages. Everybody gets to be equally poor, except, of course, the select few. Classic case. How about Senator Bernie Sanders, who has three homes? Three homes. How many of us have three homes? He's got three. And he takes charter airplanes along with AOC to go flying around the country talking about the virtues of socialism. They don't live the life. We have to live under the miserable conditions they create and have the shortages and everything else, but they don't.
Yeah, it's like the movie stars lecturing us on climate change while they're going around the world in their private jets. Al, I got a couple of questions from the text. One is, ask Al if he has the ear of Pete Hegseth, are any generals making decisions?
No.
Okay, that's quick. And here's another one. Do you think they will get a nuclear weapon, and will they use it on us if the election comes and the Democrats win? What do you think our chances are regarding dealing with them?
If you're talking about the Iranians getting a nuclear weapon, they've been beaten down pretty severely. It's going to take them a while to get one. They will if they're able to, if the Israelis don't hit them with nuclear weapons first. We just walk away, which could happen, and the Israelis are stuck holding the bag out there. They will look at this, and it's quite possible that they will be on the receiving end of a nuclear weapon, or they will launch a nuclear attack. You can have a regional nuclear war in the region with millions of people dying. Their threat to the United States is not there yet, but they do have a ballistic missile capability that is improving. It's possible, theoretically, that they could launch a nuclear missile at the United States. It's more likely they would launch one at our interest somewhere in the region. We have thousands of weapons. They would have maybe a few dozen in the next 5 or 10 years. But they have the ability to absolutely devastate the world economy because they can strike all that infrastructure that exists in the Persian Gulf. You know, you've got all kinds of facilities over there that people need to be thinking about. And, you know, you got refineries, you got export terminals, you got pipeline networks, you got lost production from major oil fields. You're talking about, what, 30-40% of the world's oil production suddenly not being available? What would that do to the world economies, especially ours and everybody else's? Right now, we're about 20 million barrels short a day in production worldwide, which is going to lead to some near-term shortages and some disruptions and high prices over the next few months, unless somehow miraculously this conflict just comes to an end and we're able to get things back up to speed. We are producing oil a lot in the United States, more than we have before. The problem is it has to be shipped out of the country to be refined somewhere else because we've shut so many refineries down. Like California has shut down three major refineries. I think Exxon is closing one right now up in Northern California, a big one. They want the one down in South County. Now they're forcing them out. They're leaving because they got so many regulations that can't work. And people don't want them to be able to work. They want dirty oil to go away, not realizing that it's in everything that they have. So I don't have any good news on that area. It's just not going to be a pretty picture at all.
Well, you mentioned Israel, and then you said maybe if the United States walks away, to leave Israel by itself, which they may do the job better than we would because they've been probably wanting to do it for a long time. But what about the rest of Europe then ganging up on Israel?
Well, they're already ganging up on Israel. You know, they've got this so-called International Criminal Court trying to indict their equivalent, their Secretary of Defense or Defense Minister, as well as their Prime Minister, Netanyahu. It's a bogus organization. You know, the guy that bringing up four of those indictments was just himself fired for criminal activity on his own behalf. But, you know, anti-Semitism is on the rise. It's always been there in Europe. It's always been worse in Europe than it has been in America. And it's just come to the surface, and it's uglier than it's ever been in my lifetime. And in America, too, it's really shocking, you know, the things you're doing. Just had Laura Loomer come on TV a couple nights ago, and she was part of this podcast group that was lambasting Israel and everything else. She's repudiated all of that, including her objections, the things she learned about Ukraine. She said, you know, Tucker Carlson, Candace Owens are wrong. Ukraine is not being governed by Nazis. You know, I was wrong, and not myself, so her. And she admitted she was wrong, and she's changed her tune completely and said, you know, these people, you know, the Israelis are the good guys, and Hamas and Hezbollah and Iran are the bad guys in very clear terms, and she spelled it out. And the same thing with Ukrainians. You know, they're basically nascent democracies fighting for their life, and that's the problem.
Well, do you see, you know, because obviously what's going on around the world in the United States, we have the midterms coming up and the consequences if the Republicans lose power that it would have on what Trump is trying to do over there. Do you see us just going back to square one?
Could be. Depends on how the candidates do. Every election is local, and these candidates are going to have to get out there and start talking about freedom and freedom of choice, and then just making a real contrast between themselves and what the Democrats or the radical Democrats, the leftists, are putting forward. The leftists are vicious. They are violent. They're liars, things, and they'll use any trick they can to gain power. That's all they care about. And they hate America, and they hate most of us. They consider most Americans part of that basket of deplorables that Hillary Clinton talked about. They don't like us at all, and they want to destroy this nation. But we've got to talk about the good things.
That's always frustrated me, is how can you hate the greatest country in the history of the world where you have all these opportunities even to criticize it and want to destroy it?
Well, I don't know. Their rationale is they're just narcissistic people. They're really mentally ill, in my opinion, in many cases. You look at this, what's happening is going to be, you've never had a country like America or other Western democracies that had to put up walls to keep their people in. We've had to put up barriers to keep too many people from coming into our country, and rather to keep them out rather than try to keep our own people in. I don't see thousands of people lining up the border to immigrate to Mexico or any place else. And that's an inconsistency on their part. They just kind of ignore it and pretend it doesn't happen. But that's something I would tell kids and I would tell everybody else. I said, think about this for a minute. Why are so many people trying to come here if it's such a terrible place? We just want to get down to the border and start telling these people they're making a big mistake.
Right. Yeah, no, you're 100% right. Well, Al, we could have done an hour and a half on this. The time just flew by. I appreciate your expertise and your thoughts on all of this. And my best to you and Roberta, and we'll do it again. Thank you very much.
All right, well, thank you.
All right, take care. All right, folks. Was Al Fonzi back there in lovely East Tennessee. Susanna's coming up next following the news at the top of the hour, and enjoy your afternoon.
AM 1230 KPRL, 99.3 FM, KPRL.com, Paso Robles, Atascadero, Templeton.
It's 1 o'clock.